From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Welcome to the Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome to the Dirk Pohlman Show from Berlin, Germany, Europe. My guest is Professor Emeritus Ulla Tunander, a Swede living in Norway, a specialist for security policy and naval strategy, but also for PSYOPs, political warfare, and clandestine operations in general. Both of us specialized in the Cold War. That is how we got to know each other. I interviewed Ulla Tunander for two documentaries, and to say I learned a lot from him might be the understatement of my professional life. That's not only true for me. Ulla Tunander also introduced the term deep state into academia. His paper on the topic is essential reading for anyone who has a scientific interest in the topic. So, Dr. Ulla Tunander, please start your introduction by telling us about your paper, Democratic State versus Deep State, Approaching the Dual State of the West.
Thank you. I was in Turkey in the around 2000, and it was a lot of talk about the deep state, and then I realized that this Turkish deep state was the same as one you could find in Italy, in Greece, in France, in Sweden. So what was typical for it was some people on the top level having very close ties to the British sometimes, but primarily to the Americans. And this made it into kind of a separate entity in every state. And it was not necessarily in the cabinet or government. It was often some military people, some security people were directly involved in this activity. And there are thousands of examples of it. I don't know if I should go into all the details.
No, not at all, but maybe the case, this traffic accident that really showed to everybody in Turkey that the Derin Devlet, as it's called in Turkish, is a reality. When there was a car crash where four people who should never have been together in one car had died or were... Yeah, you can tell about that. Yeah. That's a good example.
Yeah, it was in the late 90s. In Suthurlik, in the very western Turkey, and it was some people responsible for the police forces, some people on the political level, very influential people on the political level, and some people would say a gangster, but he was an important person in the hidden Turkey, and he was, you know, famous in Europe for heroin smuggling, for example. And he was
And his passport, I think, was found in the murder attempt on Pope Johannes II. He was involved in that too, right?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly that, but he was deeply involved in the bombing attacks in Turkey in the late 70s. And what I realized was that people speaking about the deep state in Turkey did not really include the top military leadership. I mean, the Evren, who was the top general who made the coup, or was the top of the coup in 1980, he spoke about the deep state as something else from himself. It was a specific network of people that were extremely influential and could, in a way, veto the positions of the government. So that was I had a dinner actually once with the defense minister in Turkey for the coup. I mean, he told that Evren called him in the evening, in the night, and said, "You know, I want you for to become defense minister tomorrow." And he said, "Aha, that's." He didn't say exactly that word. And his wife realized that something was going on, so she tried to stop it in a way. But Evren said that your father was a general and you have been a foreign minister, and I want you as a defense minister. And he couldn't say no to that because his father had been a general. So
I want to wrap up the Susurluk incident a little bit because I don't know if people understood. So imagine there is a car and the car has an accident. And in the car is sitting the police president of Istanbul, Koçadak his name, and Abdullah Çatlı, or Çatlı, I don't know how it is pronounced really. And he's Çatlı, he's a leading member of the Grey Wolves and a drug dealer who was searched for desperately by the police and a gun for hire. He is a murderer who you can hire. And there is his mistress, which is a beauty contest queen. Gonca Oğuz is in there. And there is a member of parliament of the party of the it's called the Right Way, the party of the Right Way, and he's a he owns a ton of he's a person who owns a lot of land. He is a very rich person, and he is involved in paramilitary groups under his command as Bucak. Yeah, and they so the guy who's the police president who's supposed to immediately arrest this desperately searched for terrorist and professional criminal, sit together with a member of the parliament and the beauty queen who is his mistress in one car. And that means you cannot, it was simply impossible to say that there is nothing like a very strange connection on the top level that people from this networks, and that leads us into Gladio and these kind of things. It means that and also Italy and Turkey have been very, very important states. Turkey has been as important as Italy in Gladio, but you wanted to go on, Ola, go on.
Yeah, no, I just want to say that in the car, it was also passports, false passports, and one passport to Çatlı was signed by the, as I remember, the interior minister. So it was drugs in the car also, and all people except one died. So you couldn't run away, so to speak. But the point was that in Turkey, the deep state became known to almost everyone. It was obvious that you have a deep state. And the word was never used actually for any other countries. It was a Turkish word. But when I realized that you had quite similar structures and networks in various countries, and these networks were linked to the Americans. I mean, in Turkey, for example, when you had the coup, the station chief of the CIA had told Carter that it was our boys who did it. So it was clear that these were not just any criminals or something like that. It was really an important network directly connected to the Americans. And the same you had in Italy with a lot of coup attempts, from 64, 1970, 1973, 1974, that was not just coup attempts. It was military people, and it was people directly linked to the fascist organizations that were on the way to take over. And when they were on the way to take over, they took over, for example, the interior ministry, whether close to take over the defense ministry and the radio TV. But in that, then it was stopped, and you had people somewhere on the top level, and most likely the Americans, who stopped it because the government backed down and adapted to US policy. So that means that you had this kind of, it was a veto policy actually, or veto capability of these forces. And they were, you could say, in every country in Western Europe. So it was
yeah,
a,
to cut
you have
that,
a democracy.
In a very yeah.
You have a democracy on the...
Go ahead.
Sorry. You had a democracy on the one hand, or the democratic elite, and then you have a deep state elite that was parallel to the first one. And on the democratic side, you have the public sphere, you have the regular rules for how the state should function. But you have this parallel structure that could intervene when necessary, when some people in the Britain or US thought it was necessary. And that happens in Sweden, for example. That happens in Italy several times with these kind of so-called coup attempts, where people, was on the way to take over the top structure of the government, and then they backed down. And in Sweden, you had these submarine incidents that. It's a very good example, and I guess we should talk more about it. Yeah,
we should talk. I just want to wrap it up. I learned all of that from you. So what I tell now is what knowledge from Ula. That is the first time that the dual state or parallel state or deep state, that's all the same in these terms, was recognized was in Germany. When the Nazi government, or really in the 20s already, when Germany was ruled by emergency rule. That's the first time that some realist political scientists said there is something like a parallel structure. You have the normal government, for example, in Nazi Germany. There's the normal state. If you buy a house, if you buy a company, if you want to get shares of a company or so, that has to function. But there's also a parallel state, which is doing the political stuff. If the political party, which the Nazi party, thought that something should happen, it happened, and they were acting in parallel. And then, to cut it short, in the 50s, a professor, Morgenthau, not the guy from the Morgenthau plan, a different one, noticed that he said this is true also for the democratic states like the United States. There's kind of a second entity which is not to the changes of a government every 4 years, which comes like the autumn, spring, and winter time and summertime. They stay for 20 or 30 years, and they are the custodians of the national security, and they make decisions which can overrule the political class, and they often have trouble to understand it, and they have their own structure. So this is what you described in the paper, and Turkey and Italy are very famous incidents for that. It leads also into Gladio to have kind of armies that you can use for operations if you need it. But we come now, because in the end, in this program, we would like to talk about the events in the Baltic right now, which have a connection to what we're talking about right now. So there, you are a specialist. You have been the civilian specialist for the third, I think it was parliamentarian investigation, I think, in Sweden, because there had been incidents in Sweden in the 80s. Sweden was in a kind of war situation with unknown submarines of unknown origin who interfered, who came into Swedish waters and played around. Sweden was fighting with real weapons, with water bombs, with all their military against it. And this is what we have to explain, because not many people outside of Northern Europe or Europe, even in Germany, it was something that I needed to explain when I did a documentary about it. So we have to give an outline of the decision. It was, as I start, Olof Palme, the charismatic leader of the Social Democrats in Sweden, the biggest social democratic party in the world. Sweden was kind of a moral superpower at that time. Olof Palme was known for his protest against the Vietnam War. He was known for aiding the African National Congress, the fight against apartheid. He was a respected person in a lot of the in a lot of the other countries in the world, to see even socialist countries, more in the independent, the bloc-free countries. He was the leader of those bloc-free countries, and he was becoming again prime minister in Sweden. And that's, please explain to us what happened then.
Yes, I mean, what you when you read British Foreign Office documents, you find that they were extremely worried about Scandinavia, about Norway, and even more about Sweden. So that was clear that the policies of the Scandinavian states were unacceptable, and they had to be had to do something. And what you had in 1981, I mean, already in the 70s and so on, there were submarines in the entering Swedish territorial waters. And the former deputy CIA director, Bobby Inman, he said that, you know, we had hydrophones deployed in the Swedish waters, and we knew where the Soviet submarines were, and some entered Swedish waters. They had some training before they came, if they should, you know, go into United States water, they had to train in other territorial waters, and they used to train in the Swedish waters, but they never went into the internal water, never into the archipelagos and so on. But what happened in the 80s was that submarines went into the archipelagos, and it was very strange. But it started with a Soviet submarine that went aground close to the naval base in southern Sweden, Karlskrona. And it was standing.
And here
there.
We have a cliffhanger, Ola. We have to switch to the advertisement for sure. And hear the story of the whiskey on the rocks after the advertisement. It is one of the most interesting stories of the Cold War. So now we split for a few minutes.
Politically Incorrect on TNT Radio.
When do you think our governments started to become so corrupt? 30, 40 years ago? I get the impression it's been a process, unfortunately. A friend of mine used a comment the other day about too many of our politicians, WIIFM, what's in it for me? And that's a very sad reflection on the quality of the individual that we now have lording things over us. But do you have an idea when it might have started to be so hopeless?
The Commonwealth being able to make laws for Aboriginal people, which provided them with the mechanisms to distort history, which they have over a number of decades, in order to create this Native Title Act, which was designed by the UN, which Keating only consulted with five hand-selected failed leaders he trusted, in order to actually stop the progress of Australia by cutting off the opportunity to use all the land under subject to Native Title, which is a title that individuals cannot own, to stop Australia from exploiting its natural resources to our benefit. It's not for Aboriginal people. Definitely one of the key ways they're undermining the Australian nation is through Aboriginal people.
Weekends are better when you spend it with Mike Tennessee and Richard Carson on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Google and Facebook, they don't sell you anything. They sell you.
Facebook constantly manipulates their users. They do it by the things that they insert into the news feeds. And they do it by the types of hosts they allow their users to see.
It's what Google and Facebook are doing on a regular basis, by suppressing stories, by steering us towards other stories rather than the stories we're actually seeking. That's the real manipulation that's going on.
I was a design ethicist at Google, where I studied how do you ethically steer people's thoughts.
It will always favor one online music service over another and one candidate over another.
Google and Facebook has the power to undermine democracy without us knowing that democracy has been undermined.
There's what I call the creepy line, and the Google policy about a lot of these things is to get right up to the creepy line but not cross it.
Google crosses the creepy line every day.
Discover how society is manipulated by Google and Facebook. The Creepy Line at SalemNow.com.
Dirk Pohlman on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And back with Professor Emeritus Ola Tunando, who started to tell us the story of a submarine which was called U-137. I don't really know why, because the Russians called it, as the Soviets at that time, S-373, if I remember correctly. And it was a whiskey-class submarine, so a submarine which was, from a technological view, post-World War II, but not the most modern one that the Soviet Navy had. And it ran aground 30 kilometers south of the second most important Swedish naval base in Karlskrona. And it was a scandal that made it to all of the European press and really worldwide. It was the Soviets were caught with their pants down. A submarine running aground south of Sweden after we knew a lot about intrusions into Swedish waters. And everybody thought, okay, it's the Soviets who are doing it. That's what we have been told, by the way, by the media anyhow all the time. Yeah, please tell us the story, Ola.
Yes. I was giving a lecture or speech, actually, at the Naval Museum in Karlskrona in 2012. And then I spoke, I had a lot of talks then with Carl Andersson, who was the chief of staff at the naval base and who was the celebrated submarine Kalle, as he used to be called in Sweden. And everyone knew about him, and he was, you know, a very public person. But then he spoke, when he spoke with me, he said, but it wasn't like that really. It was what he thought was very strange was in early in the morning, the American attachés were already there. And also, when he
I think we have to explain to the listeners a little bit, because this is something that is they are not familiar with. The official story was that the Soviets wanted to spy on Karlskrona, and they sneaked into the Swedish waters, and then they ran aground, and Carl Andersen was the one who in the morning got a report that there is something big and black sitting on a rock south of Karlskrona, went with a boat there, and to his surprise found a Soviet submarine, which was half out of the water, running, which ran on ground, and with a really distressed crew who didn't know what to do. And then this is what became public. So in the Swedish waters, a Soviet submarine that ran aground, and he was the responsible person in Karlskrona, to the security officer, so to speak, a commander in rank who had dealt with this thing. So he became so famous that I think they wanted to do a movie with Roger Moore, who was supposed to depict him in Sweden. But you go on. This is the incident.
But it's more to it. And before it happened, or before Kalle Andersson knew anything, he was visited by two U.S. naval attachés, wanted to know the readiness. He was not informed about it by the chief of the naval base. So he did do nothing. It never happened before that U.S. naval attachés come and visit without he is informed in beforehand. And then he went out to this submarine that, you know, he was informed about it, and then he went out to it. And it was very strange because the submarine was standing there on a rock in a shallow fjord where there is no way you could dive. It was narrow, so it was difficult to turn around even. And what the divers found was that it was a sand wall or sediment wall behind the propellers, indicating or proving perhaps that the submarine had tried to get higher up on the rock. So why? And there was no one who wanted to escape to Sweden or something like that. So it was something very strange. And it turned out that there was a senior officer on board who had navigated the last two days, and he was was not questioned by Carl Anderson. He was ordered not to question him. So it means that it was someone in Sweden who knew that this submarine was coming and that he should not be questioned, because he was the only one who really knew how he had navigated the two last days.
Mm. And let me put that again in a short version. So the submarine, which was not under the control of its captain, Pyotr Gushchin, it was under the control of a higher ranking navigation captain of the Baltic Fleet. Avrukievich was his name.
Yeah.
So this submarine, which ran aground under the command of the highest navigation person in the Baltic Fleet, was sitting there, and the guy in charge of it from the Swedish side, Commander Carl Anderson, was officially ordered not to question Avrukievich about that. And on the morning that the submarine ran aground, two people from the American military showed up on the basis just a few hours before they discovered the submarine. The submarine was already at ground, but then they discovered, so two fishermen or two people, I don't know, fishermen, but Swedish people discovered it. And so they were witnessing the actions that the Swedes took when they got notification of the submarine. So all of that together, of course, is extremely fishy environment. And the submarine was driving into a narrow channel where it would have run aground anyhow, sooner or later, because it was not deep enough to carry a submarine uplifted, standing out of the water, not diving, but floating with a tower on the surface into this channel, on which it would have run aground anyhow. So this is the situation that Carl Anderson described. Yeah, go on, please.
Yeah, and I wrote a book about it in last year, I think, yes. And not one single newspaper wanted to write about it, which was, in a certain respect, a surprise. But it had happened many times before. I mean, I wrote books that were supported by number of ambassadors and people who represented actually the official Sweden in the 1980s. But none of the big newspapers wanted to accept the article by these ambassadors. So I don't know why really exactly, but it's clear that this stuff was felt to be too sensitive. And some people, of course, they didn't really believe in it and so on. But you should accept that the three ambassadors and one of the former major journalist in Sweden wrote a very positive or enthusiastic support for my book and so on. So that was one of these ambassadors had also been state secretary for defense and acting defense minister and so on. So it's at the very time when it happened. So you could wonder why it happens like this, but this is really a word that was not, it was incidents that not was supposed to happen that way. And when it comes to this whiskey on the rocks, so to speak, it was clear that it was almost impossible to go there without knowing where you were. And when Carl Anderson arrived to the submarine, this officer, the senior officer who had navigated the two last days, he told Carl Anderson that he was a navigational expert, which is a little bit strange when you're sitting on a small island in close to Karlskrona Naval Base. Anyway, it had an enormous impact all over the world. And the, all the big TV channels and in the US or Britain or whatever arrived, and they arrived very fast. So that was also remarkable. And you could say what happened the coming years was that it was a lot of submarine incidents. You could, people saw periscopes and they saw submarine sails all over. I mean, one naval officer claimed that it was observations of submarines almost every day. And the Swedish public opinion changed drastically. So in the in the 70s up to 1980, there were 25-30% of the Swedish public who thought that Soviet Union was a threat or a real enemy to Sweden. And in 3 years, these figures changed to 83%. So it was, three times as many who believed that Soviet Union was now a very serious threat or enemy to Sweden. And so that means also that the Social Democratic Party that was in government at the time, they had to go on defensive. They wanted to have talks with the Soviets to, to a certain respect, have kind of closer ties and avoid this kind of war threats that appeared from the Western side also. And this changed Sweden. Sweden became another country in just 3 years because of these submarines. So it's the priorities were different. You have to put priority on defense and not on social matters, for example. So that means that for the Social Democratic Party, this became very difficult. And I think the incident, or the major incident, you could say, the coming year in 1982, started the 1st of October, 1982, as exactly 40 years from now. There were submarines close to the Muskö Naval Base, close to Stockholm. And these submarines were going, almost into the naval base. And there were small submarines. It was supposedly three small submarines, or midget submarines, and three bigger ones. That was the conclusion of the Submarine Defense Committee that wrote the report 1 year after. So that means that it became a major issue, and many people in Sweden thought they were at war with the Soviet Union. And then the Soviet leader at the time, Yuri Andropov, he said that sink these submarines, so you could see for yourself what it is, because it's not our submarines.
I think we have to explain it. It came to the Swedish government. The Soviets gave messages through the Finnish president, Koivisto, through the ambassador who stated that in my documentary, the Soviet ambassador to Sweden, who is kind of a peacenik and literature person, really, and Andropov. And for the Russians, they were puzzled. The Swedish public and the world public was told that Soviet submarines were running around in Swedish waters. So what they said is, if there are submarines, you have our permission from the Soviet side to sink the submarines, attack them, because they are not ours. You will see what will come up. It will not have a red star on the side. This is what they transferred to the governments. But how much did the public know about this offer from the Soviets or to the Swedish military, you think? Because the Swedish military was fighting these ghost submarines. There was no success at all. It was all the time in the media. As you said, it changed. Olof Palme became kind of an impotent leader. He was a major figure in international politics and peace politics before. And it all was destroyed by the submarine incidents because it looked like, while he was talking to the Soviets on peace matters about a nuclear-free zone in Northern Europe and so on, they were doing what they wanted in his waters. But the Soviets were not savvy in terms of media, how to deal with this media, because this was run via the media. The media were not bought or so. They reported as they thought fit, but it wasn't fit what they reported. So this is the situation, and the Andropov says, sink the submarine. But did the Swedish people know that he said it?
He knew that Koivisto, some time later, said that he thought this was not Soviet submarines. But even Olof Palme did not know. I mean, the government did not know really what it was. It was a, you have declassified documents that show from spring 1983 that showed that the government did not know. They thought it was probably a Soviet submarine, but they didn't have any evidence for it. They have it, no one had showed any evidence. And the later defense minister said, you know, what should we do? We couldn't dive ourselves, you know. We have to rely on the military people who did that. And the military top people had collaborated with the Americans and the British on this very case. So this was it was US and British activity. And Koivisto told Olof Palme in August 83. And in December 83, he was informed by a former state secretary for defense who was at a top military meeting. He said to Olof Palme that these are Western submarines. But, you know, he didn't have any proof, so he couldn't go out publicly. But anyone who said anything public was discredited. I mean, the foreign minister at the time, he said, we don't really know what it is. You know, if it's ski tracks in the garden, you know, you couldn't say that this is the neighbor. You have to know something better, something more. But this was enough to force the foreign minister to leave. The media campaign against him was, you know, really harsh, and he could not survive this media campaign. So you could say that the kind of media, the extreme media control of the people's awareness and people's understanding of the world at that time was equally problematic as we have today. And I think that when in the 1980s, I believed it was Soviet submarines because everyone wrote it was Soviet submarines. But then I had a talk with the former CIA director and Secretary of Defense, Jens Schlesinger, and he indicated clearly that this was a Western or US submarine that had been damaged. And I spoke with a Norwegian diplomat who had been...
I think you have to explain what submarine had been damaged. You said there was a submarine damaged. So what happened there?
Yeah, I mean, first I didn't know. I mean, I knew, I had spoken with a diver actually in mid-80s who said that he had attached a wire to this sinking midget submarine. But it was impossible to, you know, he didn't want to.
Now you have to explain some more, Ulla. This is not clear to everybody. So there was an attack on submarines. The Swedish Navy was all the time with real weapons, and they hit something. And but this was kind of a mystery story. Nobody knew about it. What you did when in your research, you found a diver who said there was a midget submarine, and he had to attach a wire to this damaged midget submarine. Correct? Or yeah. Correct me yeah, if yeah. I tell no, something correct. Wrong.
Yeah, yeah, true. So, and but it was impossible to get this kind of information out. I mean, it was also another diver and later working at a military hospital that said the same and said that he received a U.S. military diver, and the diver was picked up by a embassy car 1 hour later. But, you know, it's very difficult when you have these stories. You know, you could say they seemed very credible, but you'd never know. But when I spoke with, you know, senior CIA people, for example, and one deputy CIA director, he said that he compared it to an underwater U-2. He said he called the incident an underwater U-2, which would indicate a small submarine under U.S. command that was sinking, and the diver was and the pilot was survived.
Let me wrap this incident up a little bit before we go to the next advertisement break. So, what you describe, and I think we have to tell the viewers, has never been publicly aired. This is the first time. So what happened is there are all these submarine incidents in Sweden, and everybody thinks they are Soviet because there had been the Soviet running around very publicly near Karlskrona in 82. What you just tell 81. Is that a submarine had been attacked, a midget submarine. It was damaged. It was lying on the ground in Swedish waters. And you talked to a Swedish diver who was ordered to attach a wire to this midget submarine, and to military hospital personnel who said that they received not Soviet personnel from the submarine, but American ones. So this would have been the proof that the incursions into Swedish waters were not Soviet, but Western. And there we have a break. Please stay with us, and we tell you the story on after the break.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
Ian was a major natural weather event. That storm is now in North Carolina, and that storm will be over tomorrow. And then the real storm begins. The storm of realization how bad the supply chain is and how long it's going to take to recover from this storm. And then, of course, there'll be the blame game. It's already really started that this is because of man-made climate change, when in reality, there are many parts of the world that are seeing the opposite go on. But you know the story here on TNT. The question is, how are we going to get this story out to a global population that seems to have been brainwashed by all this? Something beyond my pay grade, but I'll stand up for the truth as far as what the weather's doing anytime someone asks me about it. This is WeatherBell.com meteorologist Joe Bastardi for TNT Radio, asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you've got.
As an organ donor, your story doesn't have to end. The good in you can live on. In fact, you could save up to 8 lives and restore sight and health for many more. Sign up right now online as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. You'll be happy you did. And just maybe, someone else will be happy too. Go to organdonor.gov. It saves lives. U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.
You're listening to Dirk Pullman on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And back with a strange story of an underwater U-2. So in Sweden, which is looking out for Soviet submarines, allegedly Soviet submarines, running around in Swedish waters, there's the story of a damaged submarine from which one or two, you have to explain that, persons are brought to a Swedish hospitals, and they are not Soviet, they're Americans. So this is something that could have turned, this is why it's called an underwater U-2. The U-2 was a spy plane in 1961, I think, which was shut
60,
down. 1960, over the Soviet Union. Yeah. But you can tell it. Maybe you go along.
Yeah. No, it was at the Ural Mountains. And it was a CIA plane. And they was taking extremely good photos of the military facilities in Soviet Union. And it went from Pakistan, Peshawar, to Norway, Bodø. And went over, you know, very much of the Soviet Union. And this was a... And the CIA, Alan Dulles, said that the Soviets had no capability to shoot it down. And he had promised to Eisenhower that it would never happen. And if it would be shot down, the pilot would not survive. But that's what happened. And actually, we had interviewed a Soviet general who was part of the shooting down of the U-2, and it became the biggest scandal in the 1960s for the United States, as one of the biggest scandals for the United States in the whole 1960s, I would say. And what this deputy CIA director told me was that he called the incident at Muskö Naval Base in Sweden an underwater U-2. And I said to him, but the Swedes never went public, which, you know, the Soviets did. And then he turned to the third person, who was also the CIA, who was later to become a chief historian for the CIA. And he said, this first top-level CIA director, he said that, do you understand what we are talking about? And the latter one said, yes, because Ola wrote a paper that this was the first presentation I actually heard when I came to Norway. So, and this was at the Nobel Institute, actually. So what happened was, this top level CIA director, he said, okay, yes, okay. So he didn't want to speak more about it, really. And I asked him who I should talk with. And then he said, mentioned a couple of names. A former acting director of the CIA and a former administrative director of the CIA. And because they knew, they were formerly naval intelligence. So that was... it was quite clear that this was the case, and when the German television team of Arte, which you belong to, interviewed John Lehman, who was a Secretary of Navy at the time, and he said that this underwater U-2 was not American, actually. It was from another NATO country. But he also said on other occasion that they used Italian medium submarines. So that was, it was strong indication that this was an Italian vessel that were damaged. And also you could say that a couple of days afterwards, this was on the 5th of October, and a couple of days afterwards, there was a meeting in Geneva between a couple of Swedes, an officer, industrialist, and a couple of Americans from civilian and military, and the civilian was most likely CIA, and an Italian intelligence officer. And there is no reason why you should have an intelligence officer participate in this kind of meeting if it was not an Italian media submarine. So you could say that the indications are very strong, and there are a lot of Swedish intelligence reports that have been declassified that describe the two kinds of submarines, medium submarines, used in Swedish waters. And these descriptions are pretty detailed, actually, because there have been a lot of observations, and they fit exactly with these small Italian medium submarines. So it's a kind of
submarine that was damaged and found in Swedish waters, but not reported. It was not known to the public at that time, or neither today. This is the first time that someone talks about it. They were, in fact, so what Italian mini submarines, they have different types of that. It's like a strange zoo that I encountered when I started to look into this world of mini submarines. We hardly know anything about this, but they're all over, they're numerous, and there are lots of constructions, and the Italians are specialists in that. They have been since World War II, and they invented the whole thing. They invented the SEALs, if you want to call it that way, the Flottiglia di Cimamas, where was the first elite naval diver special operations unit, extremely successful. Any military force in the world was very interested in these Italian soldiers and copied that afterwards. But so this submarine in run that was aground, damaged, was it an Italian submarine? And the divers, were they Italian too, or were they American?
I don't know. I mean, it was more than one, I guess. So it was and the one that turned up was supposedly American. But I mean, what the Secretary of Navy said was that they used Italian subs for plausible deniability. So that means,
what does that mean?
You know, that means that you have when something happens, and the Americans could say, you know, this is not us, it's someone else, you know, because you cannot track this very submarine to the Americans because it's an Italian one. So that's the point, in a way. The Americans could always say, it's the others, and you know how adventurous the Italians are. You know? So this is a kind of it's typical for American kind of thinking when it comes to special operations and these kind of very hidden operations, that you always should have plausible deniability. And the Americans used Italian small vessels already from the 60s. And supposedly, I mean, I had a friend who was Chief Naval Intelligence Europe in the early 70s, U.S. Naval Intelligence Europe. And he said that they used small submarines. They had deployed hydrophones along the Swedish coast to listen to the Soviet submarines. But to repair and maintain these submarines, these hydrophones, they used small submarines, small midget submarines, and they were taken into the Baltic on civilian vessels, on merchant ships, also on tankers, for example. You could have a tanker with a compartment that is used for this midget submarine. And this was actually what happened. And when you have these small medium submarines going in Swedish water to repair or to maintain these hydrophones, of course, when you were not very happy with the Swedish policy, as happened with the Reagan administration, they were not happy with the Olof Palme and so on. So you could just let these small medium submarines show their periscopes or their submarine sails. And then
we have to go to the news now on the top of the hour, Ola. So we go on with this kind of James Bond story. You remember the tanker in one of the James Bond stories films where it could open in the bow. And so this is, but this is reality. This is military history that we talk about. And we continue after the news now.